I switched the title on this year. It was originally called Is Jewish Meditation a Thing? But as you see, as we go through the Mikarot, the sources over here, I think you'll find that closing our eyes to prayer may be slightly more appropriate. So essentially what we're going to do is try to look at the history of prayer, the history of tefillah as a diving board, if you will, so that we can try to understand what is the purpose of tefillah and how to tap into it properly. So I started with very simply the sources. The sources of the mitzvah of tefillah itself. Where do we know that we have to daven in the first place? So there's a very famous machloket that's brought out. If you see on page 1, in section A of the sources, we have, I quoted you a pasuk over here that we say every day in Shema. V'ayayim shamoa tishmu al mitzvosai. If you will listen to my mitzvahs, which I command you to do, le'ahavas Hashem Elokeichem, to love Hashem your God, ule'ovdo, and to serve Him, b'chol levavchem u'b'chol nafshechem, with all your heart and soul. So the Gemara in Tani right away says, ule'avdo b'chol levavchem, to serve Him with all your heart, refers to the service of the heart, namely prayer. This is on the first page of Tani. But when the Rambam cites this tefillah, he cuts out those two words. When he cites this source as the source of tefillah, he cuts out the words b'chol levavchem and just uses ule avdo. So if you look with me inside Sefer HaMitzvot, the Rambam says as follows. V'hamitzvah hachamishit hu yi shetzivanu le'avdo yit'ale. The mitzvah is that Hashem commanded us to serve Him. U'kvar nichpal tzivu yizeh pe'amai. And this mitzvah was doubled over numerous times. Amar in Mishpatim it says, "Ve'avadetem et Hashem Elokeichem," you will serve Hashem your God. Ve'amar, and it says as well, "Ve'otota avodu," ve'amar ve'otota avod, you guys shall serve Him, you shall serve Him. Ve'amar uleavdo, and the pasuk in Akev, which is the one that we have above us, says that you shall serve Him, and he cuts out the word "avdo bechol avchem," because he's categorizing the mitzvah as serving God. He has not yet said anything about prayer. He just has cited that the fifth mitzvah in the Torah is to serve God. As the sources continue, over here he'll flesh it out a little bit more. And we'll see. Ve'afal pi shezeat sivu yihu gam kein minat sivu yima kol elim. And while this mitzvah is an over... arching an encompassing mitzvah, kimo should be arnu b'shor sharvi, as we already explained earlier in the Rambam's roots of his explanation of the mitzvot. In a yeshbo yichud, there's a unique expression of this avoda, shehu tziva b'tfilah, and this is the commandment of prayer. So the Rambam right off the bat tells us that there's a mitzvah to serve God. And namely, the one specific itemized way to do this is through davening. So davening is not in and of itself a local mitzvah. It's a general mitzvah that's expressed through prayer. How did he get there?
Yeah.
In what sense? Meaning, well, how did he draw that conclusion?
Service of God could be community service. Service of God could be, you know, following the mitzvot and learning Torah and understanding how to apply it in daily living. So how does that necessarily mean it's
tefillah? So first of all, I think that's an excellent question, and perhaps that what might be what drives the Rambam to say exactly that it's a overarching mitzvah. It's a mitzvah kolel, right? There are a number of places throughout Chazal, like the one I cited to in Tani, that says ule avdo b'chol levavchem, to serve Him with all your heart, where the pasuk itself will go ahead and say what kind of service does he want. One of those is with the service of the heart, and Tani derives what kind of avoda do we have that comes internally. That's the avoda of the heart. But I agree with you. I think that it would be a disservice to the mitzvah to say that the only way to do it is through tefillah. I think that's correct.
Isn't it because the original avoda is kavanah, and tefillah is the replacement for that?
Excellent. So you're referring to the Gemara in Brachot that that says that the tefillah was set up as a replacement to the avodah shebemikdash. So that is perhaps another way to explain that. The only question one might ask on that is, so what? How is that not? Why is the Rambam saying that the unique way of avodah is tefillah, if tefillah is only coming as an extension of the korbanot? I think you're correct that's just a furthering of that understanding that tefillah is avodah, you know, is maybe avodah par excellence, as the Rambam explains it. But we have to keep in mind that the Rambam is pointing to us that even previous to the institution of tefillah as a replacement of you know, the avodah and the mikdash, in and of itself, there's a mitzvah. In response to this, so I cited you the pasuk above the Ramban, just so you see where he's discussing this. The Ramban cites from Bamidbar, Uvnei Aharon HaKohanim Yitkeu B'Chatzotzrot, the sons of Aaron, the priests, will blow on the horns, Yayu Lachem L'Chukat Olam L'Dorotechem, and this will be a law for you for your generation. So keep this pasuk in mind, and now let's read the Ramban. This is the Hasagot HaRamban. This is where the Ramban comments on the Rambam, and he says, "Ve'in haskama b'zeh." I'm jumping into the middle of this Ramban. He says, "I don't agree with this. I don't agree with the Rambam's assumption that this is a mitzvah mideoraita." He's referring to what you said before. The Ramban is pointing out, "Shekfar be'aruach hachami b'gemara tefillah derabanan." That tefillah is a mitzvah mideoraita that was instituted later. Right, and there's a whole discussion on what exactly that came from, whether it was connected the avot, whether it was connected the korbanot. But in general, the Ramban is actually taking up your point over here and saying that, hold the phone, it's not so clear to say that the mitzvah of tefillah is mitzvah deoraita. It seems very clear actually that it's derabanan. And if you'll skip to the three dots over here, I would love to go through the whole thing, but for the purpose of time, if we look at the three dots, umashe darshu b'sifrei. The Ramban says, I have to address one of the sources that the Rambam quotes. The Sifrei writes, Ula Avdo, Zeh HaTamud, right? The Talmud refers to this, Zot Tefillah, to say that Ula Avdo is referring to Tefillah. So the Gemara says it himself. So how are we going to deal with this? How are we going to deal with the fact that the Gemara said Ula Avdo is referring to Tefillah? So he says it's called an Asmachtahi. And asmacht is a term that's used throughout the different sources of Chazal to point out that sometimes you'll have a pasuk that will hint to something or refer to something that the Rabbanan have discussed, but it's not necessarily a mitzvah deoraita. There's a whole slew of Rishonim that discuss what is exactly does it mean. There's a Ritva in Rosh Hashanah that's famous as quoted that asmachta means that there's something hinted in the psukim, and you're kind of figuring out what's the inner Ratzon Hashem, the inner desire of Hashem, but it's not formalized as a proper mitzvah. It's something that we hint to in the psukim, but it's not actually a formalized mitzvah. So the Ramban says, yeah, you're right. The Gemara says Ula Avdo is referring to tefillah, but it's not in the sense that it's a mitzvah. It's an asmach that's a support to the idea of tefillah. And then he says something else. Olamar, maybe we could say the following. Shemichlal ha'avoda shel nilmud Torah v'shenit palel ilav be'et hatzarot. He says, part of this avoda is to learn Torah and to daven to him in the times of tzara, in the times of hardship. And it's interesting, you know, just to keep in the back of our heads, maybe a shir for another time, that the avodah is nilmo Torah and yitzpalel elav when you're in an eight tzara. That part of the avodah to serve God when we're under some form of duress is to learn. You know, it's very unexpected here. But tefillah, he's encompassing in a specific, unique mitzvah, as we'll see in a second. And if you look at the next line at the period, v'zeki inyan shekatuva, this is like we see in the pasuk, v'chit havau milchama be'artzechem al hatzar hatzorer etchem, when you will go to war in your land from an enemy who is pressuring you, v'harei otem b'chatzotzrot, you shall blow on the horns, v'niz kartum lifnei Hashem Elokeichem, and you will be remembered before Hashem your God. V'hi mitzvah kol tzara v'tzara, shetavo, and this is a mitzvah on any to perform at any point that you have a tzara, Al atzibur, it's a mitzvah on the klal, it's oklifana bitfila, to call out to God with prayer. So Ramban says maybe we can actually categorize tefila under the general category of eight tzara. That when there's a time of tzara, then there's a mitzvah there right to the David. Usually there's not, but if there's an eight tzara, then there is. We're not going to go into this deeply because it's not the main focus of the shir. But when citing this machloket, it's a very fun piece to the heart. So the Rav, is quoted discussing this. Rav Soloveitchik discussing this machloket and saying that perhaps there's not such a major discrepancy between these two opinions, that that our perspective in life may allow us, you know, if thinking in the right ways, to understand that every moment of our life, in a way, is an etzara. That if we don't have Hashem constantly at our side, holding our hand or walking us through the day, then we are intrinsically in what's called an etzara. And so perhaps there's a flavor of that mitzvah even within the perspective of the Rambam, who says they're just a general mitzvah to serve Hashem. But that's a discussion for another time. Anyway, so yeah.
It just seems from both the Rambam and the Ramban that there is some sort of mitzvah d'oraita, whether it's all the time or etzara, and that would have applied even before the Batei Mikdash were destroyed.
Excellent.
So that would seem to go against the Gemara that says that the tefillah, the established tefillot that were to replace the korbanot, seems like there is also an additional mitzvah even before then.
100%. No, 100%. I'm actually very glad that you said that, because that is a perfect segue to the next sort. So we're going to notice this discrepancy once again in this one line source on page 2. The Talmud Bavli, the Gemara, cites in Masechta Megillah the following. The Tanya, it's taught in a Braita. Shimon ha pakuli, hisdir shmona esrei brachot. He set up 18 blessings, lifnei Rabban Gamliel, before Rabban Gamliel, al ha-seder b'yavna, according to order, in Yavna. So, Rav Shimon HaPakuli is famous as the guy who, if you will, authored the Siddur, to some extent. You know, exactly what that Shmona Esrei looked like, exactly what the huge formal Siddur was, as far as Pesukei Dezimra and Birkat Shema and so on and so forth. That's its own discussion, but we see here that Shmona Esrei didn't exist in the beginning. Shmona Esrei didn't exist until the times of Rabban Gamliel and Yavna. So what happened for those roughly 1,000 years before, which is exactly what you were asking, right? If the Rambam and the Ramban are saying that these are mitzvos mideoraita from the Torah, so, right, whether it's Be'itzara or it's just the general category of Avoda, the Davin, So what happened for those thousands of years? How did the tefillah change? And, why did it change? You know, a lot of times we'll see the Rabbanan stepping in and, building on a certain mitzvah, whether it's a takana, a gzeira, an enhancement of a mitzvah, protection of a mitzvah. But when you think about something like tefillah that has such an intrinsic nature to develop a relationship with God, you know, sometimes you wonder, is the Siddur really the right way to do it? You know, we open up the Siddur and, unfortunately, we'll find ourselves sometimes just having a great, like, lip exercise in the morning, just to warm up our lips for the day. You open up Sukkot Zimra and zip through it. And this is part of what we're going to be focusing on and trying to deepen our tefillah. But sometimes we have to ask that question, did we lose something by setting up the Siddur? So I want you to hold that thought.
Please. What did we do in that 1,000 years?
Ah, so we're going to digress in order to get to that question.
Self-reflection and things like that, where you have somebody, a Zibor type person who would
formulate
something. For the
clock. Excellent. So the question was, was it
more external?
All right. So I do plan on addressing that question. I want to take a step back first and analyze a different distinction in Torah in order to deepen our understanding. To understand that transformation from the Siddur that happened with the Anshei Knesset Agdola and the tefillah that happened first.
The Rebbeim and the Gemara and the first came after, they were referring to the entire tefillah, or are they just referring to Shemoneh Esrei?
So that's an excellent question. I would say like this, it's hard to give a general rule about that. On a more general sense, when we say tefillah, we're probably more often than not referring to Shemoneh Esrei. But I think that question is going to depend on the source. Like, meaning in the context, you have to see and address that. Let's hold that question, and I'm going to try to really hit that question really hard, you know. But in order to hit a home run, we got to set up our stance first. So if we take a step back for a second, there's an interesting contrast between two different lashonot, two different choices of words that different sources in Chazal like to use. And in fact, the two next sources. Almost every word in the source isn't necessary. I have about a sentence there just so you could see the context. But the first two words of each source is what I really wanted to get at. In the Talmud Bavli, in the Gemara, there are many ways to refer to a proof. But one of the most common ways that you'll ever see a Gemara bringing up a source is with the words ta shma, which means come and listen. Come and listen. I want to analyze something. I think you're wrong. I think you're right. I'm not sure what's going on. Tashma, come and listen. Let me source something and let's analyze. Right? And I'm using this to understand that the nature of the Bavli is in some way intrinsically connected with what's called Shmia, with hearing, as I'll try to explain in a second. But when you look at the Zohar, the Zohar is fond of a different phrase, and I don't learn a lot of Zohar. But the Zohar is fond of a different phrase, and the first two words are tachazeh, which means come and see. So the distinction right off the bat between the Bavli and the Zohar sometimes jumps out at you in the following way. The Bavli, when you think of learning a Gemara, right? So you put on your thinking cap, and you put on your boxing gloves with your chavrusa. Right? And you get up there and you discuss. What does this Gemara mean? What do these words mean? Right? Well, there's a Mishnah, but it's vague. I'm not sure. I think it means this. You think it means that. I have a Rishon that says what I say. You have a Rishon that says what you say. And back and forth and back and forth. I have a proof. I have a disproof. This and that. And sometimes, you know, like you look at the first five pages of Masachat Gittin, for example, you're spending four or five pages discussing one point back and forth, source to source, and like you'll get to like that, hey, you're like, wait a minute, what were we actually talking about? You know, and you have to go back. And it's almost like there's like a milchemta shel Torah, a war of Torah, in order to pull out, to extract one idea. To pull out one simple idea. The notion of Shmia, Rabbi Tatz likes to speak about this, and there's a number of other places that hopefully we'll address in this shir, likes to discuss that the notion of Shmia, to hear, comes as follows. If I want to give you a thought, if I want to pose something, so when I want to speak the thought, I say a word and another word and another word, and then I formulate a sentence. And the sentence can turn into a paragraph into an essay. But sometimes the last word can modify the entire sentence, the last sentence, the entire paragraph. So let me give an example. What did you do yesterday? Or what did you do today? Or what are you doing tomorrow? Or what did you do in Mexico? Or what did you do tomorrow? All of those have different meanings. And the last one doesn't even make sense. What did you do tomorrow? Right? That last word will modify and redefine everything that came first. So the mode of Shmia, the mode of hearing, means to take pieces, to string fragments together in order to extract an idea. Almost like with the Bavli. When the Bavli wants to understand something, it'll take a piece from here and a piece from there, and it'll fight it out and come up with a conclusion. And that conclusion will come only as a result of stringing a lot of pieces together, a lot of hard work and analysis. But Re'iyah, vision, works very differently, and we see this perhaps in the Zohar. When one thinks of the Zohar, you know, often when one thinks of the notion of like, I don't know if prophecy is the right word, or things that are a little bit out of this realm, that it's not just going to be a matter of like harsh analysis. You know, that may also be a chisaron in my own in my own, you know, scholarship that I just am not at the point to know a lot of Zohar. But often we calibrate the notion of Zohar with like the inner Torah, with Sod, with the parts of secrets that are revealing something that we haven't seen before. And the notion of a vision to see something is very different. You close your eyes and you open them. And all of a sudden, when I open my eyes, you know, millions of photons will rush, packets of light will rush into my eyes, hit like the retina, you know, and the retina will take this vision and immediately translate it into something. I know who I'm looking at, I know where I'm at, I know the colors of the room. You know, sometimes I have to focus to say, oh, that thing that I see is black, that thing that I see is white, that thing that I see is red. I have to stop for a second maybe to point to things, but the whole vision comes in at once. And the transformation from re'ia to shmia also highlights the transformation, perhaps, from nevuah to chachma. You follow from prophecy to wisdom. We often think of a nevuah of a prophet speaking a thought that he saw. It's a vision, and he'll talk about what he saw, and contrary to that. You know, you'll have the Bavli, which is, you know, I heard something from my Rebbe, back and forth, and it's a very, very different type of experience. It's the notion of working hard and battling. Let's flesh this out a little bit more. I quoted a famous, I brought down here in the sources, I thought this was something very interesting to distinguish between hearing and seeing. There was a famous debate in the 1960s. I remember learning this in high school, and I pulled it up on the New York Times history piece. A debate between Nixon and Kennedy. So I'll just read to you a couple lines over here. Although you could could probably tell me about this. At the start of the 1960 campaign, John F. Kennedy was a long shot to win the Democratic nomination because of his Catholicism and his relatively undistinguished record as a senator. Vice President Richard Nixon easily won the Republican nomination, and he and running mate Henry Cabot Lodge led in the polls on Labor Day, et cetera, et cetera. And what I'd like to point to is the turning point. You see that sentence, the turning point? It's halfway through the paragraph. The turning point of the campaign came on September 26th, when Kennedy and Nixon debated in front of 70 million television viewers. Television viewers thought that Kennedy looked well-rested and photogenic, and Nixon, on the other hand, appeared tired on television, and many people thought his 5 o'clock shadow made him appear sinister. Polls showed that radio listeners believed that Nixon had won the debate, while television viewers thought Kennedy had been superior. Now, far be it from me to take sides in any political debate. And this is not what I'm coming to do at all. But one has to scratch his head for a second and say, wait a minute, you're telling me, seeing is believing. You know, the entire country was listening or watching this. The people who heard the content, what was actually said, right, thought that Nixon did a better job. But the people who saw how good-looking Kennedy was or how well-dressed he was, oh, well, Kennedy's going to be the right president. Wow. You know, like, that's a statement. Like, how far vision will go. I'd like to actually, if you don't mind, tell you a question.
Most people use their vision as their first sense, and they haven't developed their hearing as well as their vision. Mm-hmm. So people who are visually impaired start to develop their hearing as their primary sensory awareness. So.
Amazing. You guys are actually reciting my shir. I'm going to get there. I'm going to get to that point. That's awesome. Perfect. So the notion of that was perfect. So Nixon versus Kennedy, you know, this is actually manifest. If you ever want a good read on Jewish education, I find that Lawrence Kellman, Rabbi Kellman, wrote a beautiful book called To Kindle a Soul. And he's part of it is discussing, philosophies of education, and other parts of it are actually citing many research papers that have been collected throughout the years in psychology, specifically about the notion of television. Now, far be it for me to make a statement, television, no television. It has value in its own way in its own ways. We'll leave it at that. But one of the things that people have to be cautious about, he pointed to the fact that television has played an unbelievable role in the development of our society. And he goes through so many different factors. And just to cite one thing that I'm very fond of, I believe this research paper was written by Wash Yu, but I have to check that to confirm, that followed different regions of the country as television was introduced, and came to the conclusion that violence rates went up, doubled, alongside with television's introduction to those societies. And it made a prediction, and this was already years and years ago, that I think the average injurious assaults per year would have been dropped by about 210,000 a year. Or I believe homicides, he refers to 10,000, talking 40 homicides a year. So it's an unbelievable number. It's 40 homicides a day for 10,000 a year. That's a shocking number. Now, I certainly suggest, if anyone wants to know the precise accurate readings on the study, should see the study itself. But even if it's half true or a quarter true, it says a lot about the power of vision. So the problem is that what we have to work out here is, if vision, quote unquote, is something that could be misleading, why is it that which the Zohar is utilizing as its term? Why is it something that Nevi'im have a prophecy or a vision in their prophecy? In last week's parsha, Yitro, Bnei Yisrael, were ro'in et hakolot. They saw the sounds. So a lot of times we have the notion of re'iyah in Torah, and we have to understand why. Is there an appropriate manifestation? That is there not? So let's take a look at some of the psukim over here. I titled the section called Lost Vision. And you'll see that this will all come back to prayer in a second. So on page 3, there's a very interesting theme that I think is missed often when studying Bereishit. At the very end of the second paragraph of Perek, in the beginning of the third Perek, there's a very, very major theme. So we see that Adam wakes up and he sees Isha, he sees his wife, and he refers to her as Isha, ki me'ishul kachazot, because she came from man. And then the pasuk tells us, right at the beginning of the creation of man and woman, the first time that the Torah tells us, "Vayiyu shnehem arumim ha'adam yishno v'lo yitno shashu," they didn't have clothes on and they weren't embarrassed about it. Interesting point. And in the very next pasuk, the nachash is referred to, "V'nachash haya arum." So I left an English translation over here just to see how English often translates this word as was more subtle, more cunning, the nachash as wise, but you have to note, I think it's an important note, that one pasuk after the other, we have the same exact word in describing man and then the nachash. And if it was just those two, maybe you could write it off as, well, they're two similar words that happen to have some connections. But if you look at the rest of the pasuk, the psukim, there's something huge that comes out. In pasuk hey of Perek Gemel Breishi, we say, the nachash says to Chava, ki odeh alokim ki biyom ocholcham imenu v'nifkichu inechem, when you will eat from the tree, your eyes will open, v'yitem ki alokim yodev tovara, and you'll be like God, knowing good and bad. And in pasuk Zayin, so what happens, just like the nachash said, their eyes will open, v'atipakach v'nayinei shneem, their eyes did open, and what happened? Vayedu kierumim, they knew they were unclothed. Meaning the exact thing that the tree was supposed to do, or would do, said the nachash, was to open your eyes. And the Chumash says it did open. And what did that make? That made them see the body. That made them notice that they were unclothed, and then they hid from a god. And in pasuk yod, vayomer, so God had called to Adam already and said, "Where are you?" And Adam says in Yod, "Vayomer kochash shamati bagan, I heard your voice, va'ira, and I was afraid." Why? Not because I ate from the tree, ki roma nochi, because I'm unclothed, va'ichave, so I hid myself. Meaning he wasn't even afraid of the fact that he broke the mitzvah as much as he was afraid of the fact that he was unclothed. And how did Hashem respond? Vayomer mi gid locha ki roma, who told you you're unclothed? Hamina eitz asher zviticha. Did you eat from the tree I told you not to eat from? Meaning that Hashem is also highlighting exactly what Adam highlighted, exactly what the Nachash highlighted. that there was a transformation in their lives, that they were going to notice that they were unclothed. Why is this theme significant? What is the notion? And by the way, at the end of the Aliyah, one of my favorite psukim in all of Torah, in Kaf Aleph, what does Hashem do? It touches my heart when I read this. Hashem gave them clothing of skin, hide presumably, leather. There's a discussion in the Rishonim. Some suggest that that actually means that they didn't have skin, and now they were given skin. It's a pretty picture, right? Vayal b'shem, and then Hashem dressed them. But what we're seeing here is Hashem, as the tikkun for the sin, he covered them. Meaning he understood that they were unclothed, and he started their tikkun, and he dressed them lovingly. Or at least I translate it as lovingly. That's why it connects to me. But what really happened here? What happened with Adam and Chava? So I want to suggest the following. Why did it not matter prior to eating from the tree that that they were unclothed and their eyes open? Weren't their eyes open before? So the Talmud refers to someone who's blind. And this is where your comment is going to come in. Someone who is blind is referred to in the Talmud as Sagi Nahor, someone with lots of light. So the Talmud usually points to the notion Sagi Nahor, usually in the Gemara, highlights the fact that this is when you say it's a Lashon Sagi Nahor, it's kind of like a euphemism. But I'd like to believe that perhaps the euphemism in itself has the truth. Why does a blind man have Sagi Nahor? Why does he have lots of light? So there's a number of sources that refer to Adam and Chava as being light. That they were light with an Aleph of Reish prior to the sin. Whether it's literal or metaphoric, that the Neshama was so bright that they saw straight to the Neshama. The transformation of the tree meant that they were no longer going to define themselves as their internal selves, as here, but as the skin, as the body. And the Lashon, Ayin Vavresh, skin, is also the letters for the word blind, Iver. Because when you open your eyes, sometimes you become more blind than when they were closed. Isagi, Nahor, someone who's blind, if I have a conversation with you and I can't see you, then the only thing that I have access to is your inner world. I can't access your outer world. I only know you from what's inside, right? In Hebrew, actually, the face, right? When we cover ourselves, like Hashem did to Adam and Chava, the face is not covered. The panim, right? The word panim is milashon panim. It's from the inner world, because the face reveals that which is on the inside, your thoughts, your inner self. So why am I telling you this? What does it have to do with the sitter? So we've drawn a very major distinction between seeing and hearing. Hearing is extracting truth from a dark world where you can't see. And vision can cheat to you, right? It can make you think something that's not really true. It takes you away from the ikkar, if you will. It makes you focus on the exterior and not go to the interior. So does that mean that vision is never appropriate? And I think the answer is no, that's not true. Vision is appropriate when it is that which you are beholding is truth. Meaning, when we use our eyes and see the exterior, then we've lost something. But if I can use my eyes to look at something and allow it to give me truth, to see emes, if I'm beholding truth, if I'm beholding words of a Torah, if I'm beholding the Aron Kodesh, if you will, or whatever it is that I'm beholding, if I'm looking at something Kadosh, if I'm having a vision from Hashem as a Navi, right? Vision means something that is okay to see, something that will give you truth. It'll be a powerful truth, but it has to be by looking at the right thing. We close our eyes, though, when we want to see truth. So now, when it comes to the application of prayer, the Navi, beautiful. The Navi had a prayer that was not formulated, and Chazal had to formulate. Why? So perhaps we can say that the Navi's vision, what the Navi saw in the world, similar to that of Adam before the Chait, was seeing truth. He had a depth to him. There was a power in his ability to go deep and to understand through Riyah, the notion of being able to generate something without Shmia. It was a power of truth that they had that was lost when we went to the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. The Anshei Knesset HaGdolah picked up on the fact that there was a transformation from the period of the Nevi'im to the period of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, that we'd have to let go of the world of Nevuah and hold on to the world of Chachma, hold on to the world of wisdom. And the way to live in the world of wisdom is not through Re'iyah, it's through Shmiah. And so if you look for a second at page 4, and with this hopefully we'll be able to close off, there's a very interesting Mishnah Brura. It's at the top of the page. So the Mishnah Brura says, if you look at the third line, the Mishnah Brura quotes something very interesting. Katula Acharonim. The Acharonim wrote, Shekol Misha Einu Otsem Einav V'Sha'at Tfilat Yurchet. When someone does not close their eyes during the Tfilah of Shmona Esrei, Einu Zoche Lirot Pnei Shechina V'Tzeit Nafsho. When he passes away, he will not be able to behold the Shechina. In other words, he has to close his eyes so that when it's time to utilize vision properly, he'll be able to see for real. But, however, imit palel besidur, if you utilize the sitter, ve'inat pekuchot, and your eyes are open, kidei lir'ot bo leitlan ba, then you don't have to worry about it. If you're opening your eyes to see the sitter, to look at truth, then you don't have to worry. If you're beholding truth, then you will not lose the ability to see the Shechina, because you too will still have been able to envision truth. Follow the distinction? That the notion of tefillah is supposed to be done with the eyes closed. In other words, we're not supposed to be looking at the outer world. This is the time to divest from that which our eyes see, and to be zocha tesagi nahor to lots of light.
Isn't it preferable that you daven with the sitter than without the sitter?
So that's actually a machloket that's being cited here in the Mishnah Berurah. And I'm going to leave it as ask your local Orthodox rabbi. But the Mishnah Berurah seems to say about this. If you look in Siman Sadi Gimel, I believe, he talks about the notion that there's different ways. Like the Arizal, for example, would look actually at the sitter. That's a big source. You know, there's a lot of discussion on it, and I think part of it's also that it feels very personal, and you have to find what connects with you. The Maharal talks about this as well, if a person can really dive deeply with his eyes closed and do it, but if you need the sitter for the basic concentration, then that's better. So meaning, I think it has to do with a lot of that personal sense. So I'd like to show you one Rabbi Nachman quote that I find beautiful. For the sake of time, I'll quote it on the outside, but I think it speaks so powerfully. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov says something. He says, we open our eyes when we want to see something close. When something's a little further away, though, you have to be mitzamtzem your vision. You have to kind of like a squint in order to cut off some of the light, right? And I apologize if you've heard me quote this before, because I quote it a lot. But sometimes you have to cut out some of the light so that you could see something further away, so you can focus and zero in. But he says, if you want to look at tachlis, at tov, at goodness, at something that's truly good, if you want to look at something that's very far away, you have to close your eyes completely. Because the things that you want to see that are so real, sometimes when we look with our eyes, we miss it entirely. There's distractions. There's things taking us away from what's real, from the inner world. And it's our opportunity and in some ways our duty to learn how to close our eyes to see what's real. And finally, you know, in the Shema, right, it gives a new meaning to the word Shema. What do we do when we say Shema? We cover our eyes. We close off our vision in order to Shema. To hear, to take a fragmented world with pieces that seem so broken, and to take 1 second and to reach in for the truth, to see that everything's Hashem, Hashem Echad, to find that inner truth when we cover our eyes. So now, the problem is that we're describing tefillah nowadays as something that was structured with words that Chazal gave us, because we're looking at a world that's often misleading, misguiding in what we see. We have to either close our eyes or be mabit at the sitter, to look at the truth of the sitter to give us direction, to give us guidance. But sometimes when we're using the words, we feel trapped from that, because the tefillah prior to when Chazal set it up was a tefillah that you would generate from your own words. Hashem, I need you today. Hashem, thank you for letting me wake up, or however that tefillah went. But in Bereishit, I'm going to show you this last point, and I want you to hold this. If you have a pen, you can circle it. We have the numbers of the of a teva are shalosh meot, hamishim, and shloshim. The dimensions of the teva of the ark. Why am I? I'll tell you why I'm citing this in a second. Were 300, 50, and 30. The Rama Mipano, a famous Mefarish, a famous scholar of Judaism, points out that the letters 300 are Shin, Chamishim is Nun, and Shloshim is Lamed. So the letters of Lashon. And the word, the letters of tongue. The word Teva in Chazal actually means a word. We use the word Teva to refer to the Ark, but the word Teva means a word. Why is the Teva connected to the letters Lashon? Why is a teva connected to the notion of a word? Is that a teva can be filled tremendously. It's a structure that could be utilized to put in a giraffe in here and a lion and a family and so on and so forth. And you could fill a teva. And a teva, a word, contains so much meaning if you choose to use it that way. And so next time when we're going to go into Shemona Esrei, if we feel bounded by the words, Just the opposite. Find the word and fill it. Baruch means the source of blessing. The next time you hold on to an apple, right? You can think of the fact that there are 60 trillion cells in the average body. Hundreds of roughly 100,000 times the amount of people in the world, right? And every single day your body is feeding those cells and taking an apple, right? And breaking it down and dropping off the necessary pieces, the necessary proteins to different cells and picking up the trash on the way. And the word Baruch all of a sudden becomes a teva filled with godliness. May we be zocha to fill our tefillos of today with the inspiration of old and have a very, very inspiring opportunity in every time that we talk to Hashem. Thank you.